Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the show, we'll take your questions on women's health issues, something we do once a month, always on the fourth Monday. This is Monday. My goodness.
It is the fourth Monday.
That's right.
But usually at the 10 o'clock hour.
Right. Usually 10 o'clock hour. Our guest, Suzanne Troopin. She is a physician, also professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. She also is in private practice, does a wide range of research on women's health topics, and she always stays in the know about some of the latest information about women's health issues, of which there is so much new stuff all the time. So the point of this is to take your questions. You are welcome to join us. All you have to do is pick up the telephone, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. And good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
I'm having trouble keeping track of what day of the week it is at this point. So anyway, glad to see you again.
Thank you. I don't think we've done the show together for a little while.
It has been, I think, since actually last year. I don't get to host the show often enough. I always love it when you're here.
Thanks.
So tell me what we talked briefly. There are a bunch of new things. Let's dive in.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so I thought in my show next month I would talk a little bit about breast cancer, and I thought to segue into that I would talk about benign breast disease, particularly the so-called condition or disease, depending on which textbook you pick up, called fibrocystic breast condition. It's also been called fibrocystic breast disease. They say that 7 out of 10 women will have some degree of fibrocystic breast changes before she transitions through the menopause. So it's an extraordinarily common condition. When women's health providers do surveys of what women worry about the most, they do say breast disease and breast cancer. And when women experience either lumpiness or a particular lump or breast pain, of course, they're worried about cancer. But once we can establish that it isn't cancer, they worry about the condition itself and what it might mean and how to take care of themselves and what treatments to use. This condition has a bunch of different criteria. On one hand, women may have generalized breast pain. Women may have a specific lumpiness to their breast. Actually, their mammograms may be more difficult to interpret. This is, of course, more important for the woman over age 35 because the mammograms may be so-called dense. And they have done studies where we've taken biopsies and looked at them under the microscope. And in some breast textbooks, they say there are 70 different histologic diagnoses that go along with this condition. So some of these are very difficult to interpret or treat. And really, we haven't had very effective treatments for benign breast conditions, no matter how common it has become. And what many healthcare providers haven't realized is how much discomfort some women are in. That in a recent survey, when they asked women, are you in so much discomfort that you would skip work? Well, point of fact, not many women were truly skipping work, but if they could, they would have. Mm-hmm. And many women will skip their method of activity. So maybe you can't do golf certain times of the month. Maybe you can't play tennis certain times of the month. Maybe gardening or even lawn mowing or even housekeeping during your most sensitive times during the month was becoming very difficult, and people avoid their normal activities. And some people are in enough discomfort, they actually even go to bed and rest on those days if they can possibly. So it's actually responsible for quite a bit of what the medical professionals like to call morbidity. So not necessarily something that kills you, but something that definitely disrupts your life and is uncomfortable. And we've tried a variety of things that don't work. We've tried things like just cutting back on caffeine. That's always a big suggestion that people say. We tell our patients to get a better bra. And things like this probably help to some extent. In some cases, women who go on birth control pills, their condition's a little bit worse. In some cases, it's a little bit better. But we found that probably the natural ways of treating this condition with vitamins and minerals and antioxidants are probably some of the better ways to treat this condition. And so to this end, there's been various research on a particular vitamin or a particular mineral or a particular type of antioxidant. And surprisingly, the research wasn't very effective. So we do tell our patients to try vitamin E, for instance, but there are probably as many papers that say vitamin E doesn't work well as papers that say it does. And like with so much else in holistic medicine, and so much else in terms of supplements, we've discovered that what works well is probably going to be a combination of these things, that all these things taken individually have some ability to help some women, but that combinations are what's really going to work. So to this end, I'm starting our first food study that my center's ever actually participated in, and it's actually a food supplement to treat breast pain, so that'll be kind of exciting. It's not something you can run out and do on your own at home yet, but we think that it shows a lot of promise, particularly for people who have that cyclical kind of breast pain where some days out of the month it's very uncomfortable.
So what is this condition called?
Fibrocystic breast condition. So if you look at your medical chart, they might say FCBC, so fibrocystic breast disease. And for some women, they just say, my breasts are fibrous. Or some women may say, my breasts are lumpy. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, it's all a similar condition.
And you said that 7 out of 10 premenopausal women experience this to some extent.
Yes.
Yeah.
So very common.
Is it associated with a worsening condition, or is it a predictive factor for any other disease?
Well, what we worry about is that it might be potentially predictive of cancers. There are some women with very lumpy breasts that it's somewhat difficult to feel a suspicious lump. So the studies have had a little bit of trouble deciding whether the women are just escaping detection or whether there are actually some types of fibrocystic breast change that are precancerous. And we've eventually established that in those women who have lumps, where the lumps show tissue changes consistent with things that we generally call atypia, there's a few other terms, medical terms that we use, but slightly changed breast tissue, those women probably do have an increased risk of cancer and should be very careful not to skip their mammograms, which is our best way of detecting cancer.
Okay. We're talking this morning with Suzanne Troopin. She's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, taking your questions on women's health. If you'd like to join our conversation, your questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455.
And speaking of mammograms, they did come out with a study just recently that specifically looked at digital mammograms and whether or not this is a better type of mammogram. And in fact, the new study has shown that a digital mammogram probably is better. We know that using that digital image, that the radiologist can work with the image to enhance certain areas and decrease the lighting of backgrounds and so forth to make sure that they can see the abnormal areas more clearly. And in fact, the digital machine is a breast mammogram machine, very much like the images that are generated with the actual x-rays. But because the digital image is better and you can manipulate it, they shouldn't have to compress as much. So that this is important for someone with sensitive breasts, because I know patients who say, I have so much discomfort with my breasts, I don't dare get a mammogram because I can't tolerate touching without the compression that it takes to get a good mammogram picture. And also I have many patients who've had breast augmentation, implants. They worry that so much compression could damage or disrupt or cause a problem with their implant. While that's relatively rare, the more compression there is, particularly on an older implant, that might be a consideration. But with the digital mammograms, hopefully we won't have any excuses. We'll get everybody in to have their test.
How new is this, and is it widely available?
It's not widely available yet. There's only one of our two hospitals in town that uses it right now. The digital machines probably have become available in the past 3 to 4 years, but like other new technology, they're very expensive. And we have many, many mammogram machines in our community, so it'll take a while to get all those converted over to digital.
Is there a good sense of how many women are getting mammograms on a regular basis and how many aren't?
You know, I think they have done those studies, and I think it's very age group related. And like other things in medicine, if you don't have a consistent set of recommendations, sometimes it's confusing for patients. So nowadays, as patients change insurance plans and they go from provider to provider, we've had some providers saying, we'll get one every year, and some providers saying, we'll hold off until you're such and such age. So I think it's introduced a little bit of confusion, but we do like the first mammogram done before the age of 40. The American College of Obstetrician Gynecologists recommends that you get mammograms every couple of years between 40 and 50, whereas the American Cancer Society still says every year after 40. And after 50, the guidelines come together and say once a year. There's a little bit of disagreement in the literature as to when you should get your last mammogram of your life. And some people feel that you're never too old for a mammogram. And other doctors feel that if your health is such or your longevity is such that the information in the mammogram isn't going to change what they're going to do, they stop getting them. But for most of our patients, and we're planning to all live to ripe ages, that you should keep getting them every year. And there seems to be a little bit confusion. A lot of people that actually have insurance coverage for mammograms think that they don't have insurance coverage. This was a new study just done, and that is a little bit disheartening. But many insurance companies have some problems in terms of covering new or newfangled things or screening tests. But virtually all insurance companies cover screening mammograms, and that shouldn't deter women. In Illinois, we're very fortunate to have the Breast and Cervical Cancer Project that can fund mammograms for women who are in that kind of gray zone. They don't qualify for state health benefits, and they don't perhaps have good insurance coverage. And that's another nice thing about when we do our studies. And anybody who's of mammogram age, if there's any treatment that is anything that would potentially impact on that, we do cover mammograms for our patients that participate. So that's always a health benefit.
Okay. Well, we have one caller waiting and time for others. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopen, taking your questions on women's health issues. Any issues are open for discussion here, and you can join us very easily, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a Charleston listener on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, I got a mammogram, and then they called, and I had to go back and take another one and on one side. And then they said that there was something there, but they thought maybe it was benign. But anyway, they said they'd send the information to my doctor. And when I talked to the doctor, he said, would you want a second opinion, or maybe see a surgeon? And I said, well, I guess I'll take their word for it. They said to come back in 6 months. So now I've been thinking, and maybe I really should have gotten a second opinion, so I don't know.
They did a very interesting study in the New England Journal of Medicine. I think it's already been a couple, 3 years ago, and they looked at women participating in mammography over a 10-year period of time. Now, this was done before many digital images were available. I'll get back to that in a second. But, excuse me. And what they found is that of women participating in mammography programs, about 1 in 3 got called back for extra views. And this is something that I try to warn my patients about, that getting these other views, sometimes needing ultrasounds, sometimes even needing biopsies, or sometimes needing a earlier follow-up mammography, is very common, and it's quote-unquote part of the program. It's the way we ensure that we're not missing something. On the other hand, you have to step back a little bit and realize that cancers start when they're very, very tiny, and it can even take 10 to 12 years for a cancer to get to the size where it could be felt or found on mammogram. And so sometimes when we tell patients, come back in 3 months, come back in 6 months, it seems like a long time. But in the life of a potential cancer, it's actually a very short period of time. And we haven't shown that even if there was something that we missed, that amount of time frame that we're waiting to get those follow-up tests and establish exactly what's going on doesn't usually affect overall treatment or survival. And that the mammograms are somewhat difficult to interpret. They have a known what we call false negative and false positive rate. So not everybody who has a spot on mammogram has a cancer. Not everybody who's told they have a normal mammogram is, in fact, 100% normal. But that these follow-up tests are very commonly used. And that's another reason, though, that getting back to the digital topic, that I like the digital images because the tech can look at them right then and there. And if there's something, she can readjust and take some of those extra views right then and there. And they think that the callback rate's going to be much less, which I think will be very reassuring for patients.
So you think then the 6 months would be all right to wait? Or
it's, you know, of course we don't treat anything over the telephone, but and just in medicine in general, I fully endorse second opinions. But if that's all your doctor thought to get that follow-up mammogram, typically that's a very reasonable suggestion that could be gone with.
Okay, I was wondering about the digital because I thought, well, maybe I should have had that and they could have seen a little better. They said there was something there, but they thought it was benign.
Well, our breasts are, you know, nobody's looking at you over the radio, of course, but breasts aren't pancakes, but you get the better image when they're somewhat flatter. So they do compress the breast, and that compression, it's like if you have, say, a sheet of very thin paper and you hold it up to the light and you can see through it. But if you take that piece of paper and you fold it over three or four times, hold it up to the light, you might not see through it. And what happens is when those blades compress the breast, there's areas that get kind of folded over and they look dense. And the way they establish whether that's a true spot or a, what we call an artifact of the way the x-ray was done, is that's why they take those funny views, and they take sometimes shooting straight down from your head towards your toes and sometimes shooting from the side inward. And sometimes they do those funny views where they're actually shooting diagonal to try to be sure that it's not a true spot. So just seeing something on the film, what they're trying to establish is there really something in your body, or is that just a consequence of trying to get the test?
Mm-hmm.
Without a blackboard, these things are hard to explain.
No, that was a good explanation. Thanks. Good explanation. So 6 months later, if it's an artifact, it probably would not appear in the same spot.
Probably not, and they might take extra views. Sometimes just by alternating the view, what you do is you see it in maybe one view, but not in the second or the third view, and that's how you know it's probably not something real. And if it's something abnormal, those grow and change. So you're looking for any growth or change.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
We have another listener waiting, line number one in Champaign. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I was I recently stopped nursing maybe about 6 months ago. And about 2 months ago, I wasn't leaking anymore for about a month or 6 weeks. I didn't leak anymore after that, after I stopped nursing. And then 2 months ago, I've started experiencing a lot more tenderness certain times of the month, kind of like what you were describing earlier. And it's just really painful, right? Almost towards and even under my arm. So is that kind of a sign? And also there's been some leaking that has started up again, and that's just been in the last 2 months. And I know that if you breastfeed, that's always kind of that might happen, but it seems like once it stopped, I didn't expect it to start up again.
Well, it is true that once you've breastfed, there are women that will retain that ability to make small amounts of milk over time, and there may be something else going on in your diet or medication that you're taking, something like that, that has changed what's going on.
Okay.
Birth control pills is a good example that many women are, of course, on birth control pills, and they have hormones in them that will stimulate that milk production to continue rather than to necessarily dry up. So that's a possibility. Certain kinds of exercise during sex, extra manipulation of the nipple, those kinds of things actually factor in. So there are some conditions that we look to see if there's anything simple, if it truly is milk, and a doctor can figure out if it's truly milk or not by what we do is we put a slide on the discharge, and sometimes we add a little bit of salt water, and we just look at it under the microscope. And under the microscope, if it's just milk, it just looks like fat droplets. But if it has blood, or sometimes if the fluid turns out to be somewhat greenish, then it's more likely associated with fibrocystic breast conditions. Uh-huh. If it's frankly bloody, then there may be other conditions as well that are a little bit more likely to be something worrisome, but not all cases of bloody nipple discharge are worrisome.
Okay.
But it may just be that that you have developed some fibrocystic breast change. It sounds like it with the cyclic nature of your symptoms, and sometimes just getting that treated in terms of the discomfort and the lumpiness will help some of the discharge go down. They may be related. They may not be completely related.
So should I get an appointment with my OBGYN? Is that
it? Sounds like it.
Okay.
So OBGYNs check that. Probably some primary health care providers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants.
I shouldn't have that much pain then.
No.
Okay. So that's okay. Because the only other thing I did recall back when I was like 19 or something, which was many, many, many years ago, I did have fibroids develop. Under my arm, there were lumps under my arm, but the doctor then diagnosed that as being caused primarily by caffeine. And so I don't even drink any caffeine now. Maybe a cup a week, if anything. So over time, does that then come back?
Yes, it might, and it might have been under control while you were breastfeeding and pregnant, and in fact, that may be what's going on, and that is related to fibrocystic breast condition. And as far as the caffeine story, it's one of those things. I'm back to saying moderation rather than completely eliminating caffeine, because in some studies there hasn't been a tight correlation between no caffeine and really being able to eliminate the condition. And so for other listeners, I think that very modest amounts of caffeine are probably perfectly reasonable, even if you have breast conditions.
Okay.
But there aren't a lot of real treatments, which is one of the reasons we're excited to be participating in this study, because many things have been tried and they haven't worked particularly well. And I know a lot of my patients do try vitamin E, and that's something that you can try. Some doctors recommend 400 international units a day. Some doctors recommend up to 800 international units a day. Potential side effect of vitamin E for older women is increased risk of heart disease, which, you know, is flip-flopped. We used to say 6 months, a year ago, I was saying the opposite. But for young people, the possible consequences of extra vitamin E per day is probably basically negligible.
Okay.
We can do more good than harm.
Okay. So that it would suggest then an appointment. The only other question I had was, so if, and you said maybe medication could also, besides birth control pill, which I'm not on.
There's a list of literally hundreds of medications that can cause breast nipple discharge.
Okay.
And it would include various antidepressants, psychiatric medicines, some water pills, some antihypertensive medicines. And what the PDR is, the physician's desk reference, is it's a compendium of all the package inserts of any medicine. So that's a good source.
Okay.
It's even accessible online, or possibly calling your pharmacist if you are prescribed something and saying, hey, how about what I'm on? Is this a medication that can produce that?
Okay. And then the final question, given my, you know, this sensitivity, when do I get to do the breast self-exam? Because it's, you know, it's very painful. So they always say wait 2 weeks into your cycle, and yet that's kind of when things start to hurt.
Yes, some people have their worst symptoms that cluster not only around the menstrual cycle, but also around ovulation.
Right. I think that's my case.
Well, with breast self-exams, there are a couple of things about that. First of all, anybody that's doing breast self-exams, it's important to use the right technique. So review your technique with your healthcare provider and make sure your technique is reasonable and that maybe there are some suggestions in terms of technique that can decrease the discomfort. Second of all, it's a good idea not to do it more than once a month. And there are some studies that indicate that you wouldn't even have to do it once a month, but it's important not to do it more than once a month. So try to target approximately the same time of each cycle. And that's probably about as consistent as they're going to get. Recently, they've done some studies that show that women who participate in breast self-exams, they couldn't show an increase in longevity, although more women do find their own breast cancer. A large number of women do find their own breast cancer, but often they find it feeling their breast outside of the concept of breast self-exam. So that when they've done the studies looking at whether or not you could show that it actually improves survival to do breast self-exams, mm-hmm. they haven't been able to show that. And in some studies, what was a little bit worrisome is that women who participated in regular breast self-exams were more likely to get extra doctor's visits, extra biopsies, extra tests and treatment. And so they've backed off a little bit on that, and they still recommend going with mammography guidelines. They still recommend getting what's called a clinical breast exam, so a healthcare professional to check your breasts at least once a year. And for somebody who skipped their checkup last year, if there are any listeners out there who did, very important to get in and at least have a breast exam once a year. And in terms of breast self-exams, they've removed that recommendation for some women. So
okay.
It's something that you should probably sit down and
okay.
and work out with your own healthcare provider.
Right. Okay. Well, wonderful. Thanks for your help.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We're past our midpoint here with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology, University of Illinois College of Medicine, talking about women's health issues. Your questions are welcome on any topic related to women's health. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have open lines, so feel free to join us. I was going to ask you, I don't know if this it occurred to me in one of the earlier questions, the topic of records, health records, are becoming digital. And not just mammography, but everything's
sure.
becoming digital in medicine. And I guess I'm just very curious, because someone mentioned this to me the other day, that now that that's the case, it actually makes things a lot easier. Is that from your perspective as a physician?
not yet.
No, it's still transitional at this point.
That's definitely the goal. But
yeah.
I think back in the days, you're old enough to remember when VHS and Beta were duking it out.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Think of the analogous situation, but instead of two different formats with two different machines, you have literally hundreds of formats. And this has been the big problem. So although I may, and I do, have an electronic medical record, I can download and copy to a disk and give somebody their records as well as just printing them out on paper. But the problem with that is that if I do that and somebody has the disk, if it's read-writable, by the time it gets to our healthcare provider, can I certify that's exactly the way the disk left my hands? So that's a problem. And my format might not fit their format, so they can't necessarily upload those records. Might make it easier to email somebody a file, and with the new HIPAA regulations, they have come up with scenarios where you can use email and so forth, but it's still not gotten to the point where people can have as much portability and as much access with their records. But it's definitely a goal.
Okay. Well, we have a couple other callers waiting. We'll go next to another listener on line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. That's you.
Yes, I have a male question.
Okay.
I'll try.
Just the other day, from morning till evening, suddenly I had an enlargement underneath my left nipple. And I do take Digitalis. And my doctor said that Digitalis sometimes causes such a thing. I do also see an optical effect in which I see some blue-green effects, which is also related to Digitalis. But he wishes me to get a mammogram also, and I'm wondering, would that be necessary? It seems...
If a doctor recommends a mammogram, yes, in fact, you should get that. It's possible for a male to get enlargement of the actual breast tissue. The nickname for that is gynecomastia. Actually, if a woman's breasts enlarge, it's technically gynecomastia as well. But it's a condition that could be due to a variety of compounds or hormones. It's not uncommon in male teenagers as they're going through puberty, and testosterone can be metabolized to estrogen in our bodies, and depending on their level of various hormones, young males do experience this. Of course, as we gain weight in various places, and the breast area is one of the places that we gain weight. It's possible to even have a bruise. It's unlikely that it's something like the fibrocystic breast condition that I was discussing for women who have cyclic pain that we're hoping to find new treatments for. But yes, if your doctor recommended a mammogram, you need to get one.
Right. It's something that was not there in the morning, at least as I did my morning ablutions, I didn't notice it. By evening, it was very noticeable. Within 10 hours or 12 hours, it changed.
The time sequence is a little bit hard to pinpoint as to what that might mean exactly. Very often, doctors feel that maybe things do have that faster time sequence. Maybe it was a question of degree that you just hadn't quite noticed it. But ultrasound can also be used to decide whether it's, say, a bruise or a collection of fluid or actual swelling of breast tissue.
If it was something to do with such as the medication I take, if I was to cut back on the medication, with doctor's permission, of course, would I expect it to go down? Would it drain if it's tissue or a cyst that's been filling or something?
The first step in anything like this is a diagnosis. Then once you get a diagnosis, you can come up with a list of treatments. But it's very difficult to back end and come up with treatments before you have a diagnosis.
And would it be best to look around and find someone that has the digital equipment, or is that something that they all necessarily have now?
You know, I really have not seen any information about male breast tissue, digital versus non-digital, but given that male breast tissue, even swollen, is not going to be a lot of tissue, that the digital image might be better if you happen to have access to one.
I hope that helps. So we got another caller waiting on line number 1 in Chicago. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, my question has to do with breastfeeding and with what the effect on children. When a woman is breastfeeding and is drinking a lot of coffee or smoking or taking certain medications or supplements, then eventually the child gets off the breastfeeding, does that child go through withdrawal, say caffeine withdrawal or nicotine withdrawal, and is there a serious effect to that?
Well, many, many things do cross over into the breast milk, and before we ever give medication, we usually go with medicines that are both safe in pregnancy and safe in childhood. Remember, once an infant is born, there are still medicines that are safe to give for various kinds of condition, and their system can tolerate it quite well. And in terms of something like caffeine, the amount that would cross over into the milk would be fairly small. So I don't know that I've ever seen an article about caffeine withdrawal, but there are good studies that show that depending on what mom eats, the baby's behavior can change. And it doesn't have to be something like caffeine or smoking or something that you think that should be self-evident that, you know, you want moms that are breastfeeding to be moderate. It can be certain foods that mom likes, something spicy or not necessarily spicy. So a lot of things that cross over into milk can affect the baby and actually, for instance, how the milk smells. And what we eat will actually cause very slight changes to the baby's taste, and that can affect how the baby tastes. That's why we tell moms not to use, say, certain breast lotions, even though that might be soothing to your skin. It might affect even milk taste, which can affect how babies feed and eventually how well they thrive and grow. So there are many, many things, and it is very important to take the breastfeeding baby into consideration whatever mom is doing.
Hey, thanks for the information.
Okay. Thanks for the call. What about nicotine? Is that one of those that crosses over?
Nicotine crosses over. Nicotine, mm-hmm. It's interesting. It gets throughout our body. For instance, that's how we think that women who smoke have increased rates of cervical change and cervical dysplasia. And there's some that suspect that nicotine can actually increase your risk of cervical cancer. And it's not so much only nicotine. It's all the tars. There's literally thousands of compounds in smoking. And just like we concentrate some of these compounds in the mucus of our lungs, we concentrate some of that in the mucus of the cervix as well. And even though it's a very small amount of mucus compared to the entire lung surface, it's a very sensitive area of our body. And I do believe some gets over into the milk, but I think that, as I recall, and I haven't looked this up in a while, that the concentration is fairly low, and that probably being exposed to the secondhand smoke is more important than what would be in the milk per se.
Okay. Well, that's a big issue right there. Let me just mention, we're actually moving into our last 15 minutes of our program this morning with Suzanne Troopin, taking your questions on women's health. If you'd like to join us in the time remaining, you can use our Champaign Urbana number, 333-9455. That's within the 217 area code. Also, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Secondhand smoke. Boy, there's a can of worms.
Maybe not to go in that direction, but there were a couple of articles just recently regarding pesticides in human milk,
okay.
Pesticides in our urine. Mm-hmm. We have, as you know, banned certain pesticides many, many, many years ago that can still be, quote unquote, found within humans, you know, even 20, 30 years afterwards. And being fat soluble, many of these pesticides, they do cross over into milk. And it's very controversial. Certainly, if you bought a bottle of milk or a bottle of formula off the shelf, it's gonna have zero tolerance for these compounds. But these compounds, they're in mom, they're fat soluble, so that they're possibly a little bit more likely to be in higher concentrations in the milk than in, say, what is perfused from the placenta over into the infant. And this has been sort of a controversial area, and I know there's been a little bit of interest in sort of home kits and testing and getting your milk tested for this, getting your urine tested for this. And we're not really at a stage where we can do this, but I think that the question isn't only, say you test positive for a particular compound, what level is safe? And if it's not a safe level, how do you monitor the baby for any potential toxicities? So there are these vague things that are known, but we don't really have the whole clinical picture yet. So it would be very difficult for a physician to come up with a real recommendation. And that's why we still do these these studies, as much as we know, it seems like every other little thing we find out opens up the next line of questions.
So we talk about things like dioxins or PCBs,
right,
and things like that.
Absolutely. DDT.
Right, right. And I suppose the other question is, you know, so you have some small, you know, detection of one of these elements. You know, how does that also interact with some of the other elements?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I guess, you know, is there research that really tells us anything about that?
And there has been a lot of interest, and I think I spent some time on this on either the last show or the show before, right, on using omega-3 supplementation, because we think the omega-3, long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, the DHA and EPA, have a lot of important function in protecting us against harmful effects of the antioxidants. And we think that they are so important in fetal life and then eventually in infant nutrition that we recommend now supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids. And they just came out with the first new pregnancy bar that has them. It's a bar called Omama. I haven't seen it in our area. I did a little bit of consulting. So that's my commercial. You know, I did do a little bit of consulting with it, but it's not for sale in our area. But we think that's very important. Also, some prenatal vitamins do have omega-3 supplementation. Unfortunately, none of the chewable prenatal vitamins have omega-3 supplementation because it doesn't taste good. Fish oil isn't something good to chew on, unfortunately. Sorry.
Eat your fish oil.
But and that's been the big problem that in terms of fish in the United States, and we really limit how much fish that we recommend people eat because of mercury, although some local nutrition professors here at the University of Illinois have told me that they think those recommendations are far overstated, that you could eat 100 times the recommended amount of fish and probably be well within the safe mercury level. But we go by CDC and EPA recommendations, and they are to limit your fish. So omega-3 supplementation, and if you get proper antioxidant and nutrition protection against some of these things, you can withstand these chemicals much better. So that's important.
Okay. We have another caller waiting, and just about 10 minutes left with Suzanne Troopin taking your questions on women's health issues, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. An Indiana listener next on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. I'm really sorry for taking your time. I thought Lynn would be here by now. I called her at the library, and she must be caught in traffic, but let me go ahead and ask the question that she normally would have asked you. About 7-10 days ago, she stepped up on a porch to get into the porch, and when she put her right leg up, all of a sudden, I mean, this is from the history of the thing,
mm-hmm,
she got a sudden, very bad pain in her back, so she let the right leg just sort of went, and when she tried to stabilize herself, she ended up spraining her left leg and went into the doctor, and she explained it to him, and they took a x-ray of the small of her back, I guess. Anyway, it turns out she has herniated disc, and they were thinking that it had been inflamed somehow, and it pinched a nerve that caused the sudden pain in the right leg, and that, you know, the falling and trying to catch herself, that resulted in the sprain, and that's what was there. And they more or less said, just take care of yourself. And I was asking questions like, well, you know, is there sort of physical therapy for this kind of thing? Is it, can you strengthen your muscles? You know, anything like that. I was wondering if you could give some information in regard to a herniated disc. She's not real overweight. I mean, she's probably, you know, 10 pounds overweight for her size, but, you know, she's nothing huge or anything like that.
Well, the subject of back pain is an enormous, huge subject in and of itself, and they don't always understand the correlation between what they find and the pains. And many of us do have herniated discs that are small, that may be causing some symptoms, but we generally feel that back surgery is risky enough in terms of damaging very important nerves and, of course, the spinal cord.
Yeah, well, she said, you know, she made me swear that, you know, no matter what happened, she was not going to have an operation on her back She had some family members, elderly ladies, who'd had operations, and they turned out, you know, bad, to
right.
put it that way.
Well, one thing that's reassuring is they've made tremendous progress in this whole area. And there are orthopedic surgeons that just consult. There are physical therapists that just consult. Individuals who consult neurologists who don't actually do the surgery itself. Mm-hmm. So there are many physicians that you can consult to get the right recommendation as to when therapy is going to be enough. And the therapy isn't ever going to resolve that problem of the disc. The therapy is going to be to resolve pain issues, to strengthen muscles, to increase your flexibility, and to learn to perform activities that won't cause further harm or pain.
Nope.
And that's where the physical therapy helps a lot, but it will never resolve that bulging disc.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have an Urbana listener next on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I have a friend who has developed gestational diabetes very early in a pregnancy, and I happened to notice something in Consumer Reports on health that started out with talking about cinnamon reducing insulin intolerance, and then farther down in the article there was a comment that iron can interact badly with insulin, and I'm just wondering whether you know any information about that, because I know there's iron in prenatal vitamins.
Well, I think with the iron in prenatal vitamins, I don't know that they've done any studies. I've seen some of those recent reports about iron and insulin sensitivity, and I don't know of any reports that link the dosage and the timing of the iron in prenatal vitamins with something like that. Because you have to remember that when we supplement iron in pregnancy, it's a little different than when you supplement iron when you're not pregnant, so that you are giving mom iron because she needs extra blood supply. She has an expansion of her overall blood volume and expansion of her red cells. And actually, your blood volume expands to one half its time. So instead of 4 liters circulating, you've got 6 liters circulating. And you do have more red cells, but they're more dilute, so that we have to give extra iron to try to get those blood counts up to the normal circulating level. And some iron passes to the baby. Some extra iron goes into our iron stores, so to combat or offset the amount of blood we're going to lose for delivery. Some iron feeds the growth of the uterus and the placenta. So not all that iron is just circulating around the way it would be if you took supplementation as, say, an adult male or somebody like that. And in terms of the iron in prenatal vitamins, I've never heard it causing diabetes. What causes gestational diabetes is a combination of factors. Between number one, we have many individuals that are starting pregnancy overweight or on the type of diet that would decrease their insulin sensitivity. Number two, we have older moms getting pregnant, and they're a little bit more likely to be insulin insensitive as they get older. And then number three, which is probably the biggest cause, with obesity. We kind of wrestle with statistical incidence of all these things, but it's the hormones the placenta makes itself, and those hormones make you a little bit insulin resistant. And what happens is that the placenta pumps sugar across the placenta into the baby, and the baby's thrive on sugar. They mostly grow with sugar. They need little bits of everything else, but they need quite a bit of sugar. So that's why the placenta is designed to pump that sugar from mom to baby. But if mom's sugar level is high because she's not processing that sugar well, then the placenta doesn't get it. It's doing its pump thing, and it's going to just pump all that extra sugar over into baby, and now the baby's going to become relatively diabetic, and the baby doesn't have a mature system and can't make enough insulin to keep up with this. And that's why it's so important in pregnancy to tightly control those sugar levels.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We have just literally 2 minutes left, and, oh, I thought we had another caller. I guess not. All right.
Yeah, I thought, thought I saw that, too.
All right. Well, that's okay. Well, we just hit actually about a minute and a half now by the time I said that. You've got some studies. Is there anything you want to mention about that?
We have a lot of interesting things happening.
Yeah.
A couple of new studies on completely novel treatments for endometriosis, a chronic disease that produces pelvic pain in women, and as we've talked about a little bit before on this show, many of the treatments are very expensive and difficult to tolerate. So there's been a lot of interest in more effective treatments for endometriosis. I've been partnering with some internists and some GI specialists. So we have a lot of general health studies going on right now. We have one in a novel treatment for anemia, and we think anemia causes hair loss and skin changes and depression and fatigue. And so we're looking at some novel ways to treat anemia, particularly in women with heavy periods. We have a study looking at prevention of heart disease, as I was mentioning. It's our one study that is enrolling men. We're looking for men over the age of 55 and women over the age of 65 who are not on any lipid-lowering medications and who do have normal cholesterol range. And we're looking at how we might actually help prevent heart disease in this group of individuals as well. And we have a dyspepsia study that's starting to enroll. And this is for individuals who get a little bit of heartburn or bloating or discomfort, particularly after they eat, particularly if they've tried a lot of medicines over the counter that doesn't seem to be working just right. And we're looking at a novel treatment for that. So
okay.
We have all kinds of things going on.
So people want to participate.
Nice.
They can get in touch with you
at
Women's Health Practice.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we have to leave it at that. We're out of time here. Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. Thanks so much, Suzanne.
Thank you.